From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, this is Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Take a snapshot of how this country has taken care of its military veterans over the years, and there's no denying we've come a long way. In the 1970s, veterans came home from Vietnam to a public that sometimes expressed outright hostility, never mind understanding the psychological wounds, such as post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Today, there's a broader appreciation for military service members and their unique needs, but we're still struggling to make health care available in a timely fashion. It was 2014 that CNN reported on delays in service that caused the deaths of at least 40 veterans. That eventually led to a shakeup at the Department of Veterans Affairs, a criminal investigation, the resignation of top officials, and new federal funding for the VA. In southeastern North Carolina, the local VA has expanded services and facilities, but is still struggling in some regards. In response, local officials have held a series of town hall meetings to hear from veterans, answer questions, and provide support. Today, we'll take a look at some of the issues and how the local VA is working to address them. With us today is Fred Roche, administrator for the Wilmington VA Healthcare Center and the Brunswick and Jacksonville community-based outpatient clinics. Fred Roche, welcome to Coastline.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate you having me here to discuss the services that we offer our veterans on the coastal region, and I'm glad to come and speak with you.
And we're glad to have you here, and we're inviting you to join the conversation. Are you a veteran who has used local VA healthcare facilities? You can ask a question or make a comment by giving us a call at 910-343-1138 or email us at coastline@whqr.org. You can find us on Twitter at @CoastlineHQR. Fred Roche, you've held this series of town hall meetings to hear from local veterans about some of the difficulties they're running into, their frustrations with service. What do you think is the biggest challenge? What are you hearing that's facing the Wilmington VA right now?
The biggest challenge that we are facing, as well as some of our sister facilities, is access. The demand for care exceeds our ability to provide that care in a timely fashion. We have service members coming back. They're wanting services, trying to get them in. We've expanded services here in Wilmington to try to accommodate that. We've added primary care teams. We have currently 8 primary care teams to see our veterans. We've also created a women's health team. So there's a team dedicated to specifically to women's health issues. The other thing that we've been trying to do here with the Wilmington Healthcare Center, we relocated from a community-based outpatient clinic, was just basically primary care and mental health. The intent of the HCC was to be able to expand services to veterans living on the coast so that they wouldn't have to travel to our parent facility in Fayetteville. So we're part of the Fayetteville healthcare system, and we're one of 18 sites of care for that medical center. So by having the healthcare center here, we're trying to expand services that are available to veterans living on the coast to try to save them that 2-hour drive to Fayetteville. So with the healthcare center, we went from just primary care and mental health. We have a pharmacy, we have lab, we have imaging. So you can get a CT scan, you can get ultrasounds. Right now we have a mobile mammography unit that we'll be sharing with some other facilities for women's health.
And this Wilmington facility opened, the new facility opened when?
The HCC opened March 4th, 2013. We kind of phased in services as we were ramping up. Like I said, we did relocate from an existing CBOC. We had roughly 50 to 54 staff. Now we're over 200 staff. So as we were hiring staff and bringing up services, it enhanced the services that were available to veterans on the coast.
And one of the issues that has kept this Wilmington facility from operating at 100% capacity is the water contamination. Can you, for people who haven't been tuned into that issue, can you just tell us how you discovered it, when it started, and where we are with it now?
Yeah, well, we had back in last March some issues after a repair that was done. There was some discoloration in the water, and there was some concern, and we thought initially it was just from the initial repair after you do something, stuff settled, sediment settled into the pipes, and after a day or so it would clear up. It didn't, out of concern for staff and our veterans, we requested the water be tested. That's how we discovered the issue. It did impact some services.
And when the water was tested back then, what did you find?
We had elevated levels of copper and lead within the water, which made it not potable, so mm-hmm. it wasn't safe to drink.
Right.
The impact on the services, if you've seen it on the media and that, it appeared like we were basically shut down, which was the furthest thing from the truth. Basically, it impacted about 1% of the services that we offer at the HCC.
1%? I heard numbers much higher than that. Around 25% of the facility couldn't be used because you didn't know where this contaminated water was going to pop up. It was in some places but not others. Is that not accurate?
The water, as far as some of the where the water was contaminated, it was in various parts of the building. As far as the impact on the services that we were able to continue to provide to our veterans, the only services that were impacted were those that we call procedures. So dental, mm-hmm. Our gastroenterology and urology procedures were impacted by the water issue. Not because we couldn't perform the procedures, but with those types of procedures, there's a medical equipment that we utilize that needs to be sterilized. And because we were unable to sterilize that equipment, we couldn't perform those procedures here at the local facility. So all in all, as far as the services that we offered, it was a small part of the services that we provide here.
And you're now providing those services.
Correct. We were able to make arrangements to resume dental services back in October. So we were able to do dental procedures. We were always doing dental services, cleanings and routine exams and that, but the actual procedures, extractions and that type of thing, we weren't able to do again because of not being able to sterilize equipment.
And you're able to sterilize equipment now because of your own system that you've put in to do just that, but the water issue is not resolved.
Correct. So on February 8th, just past Monday, we resumed our gastroenterology and urology procedures. We did install a filtration system that allowed us to sterilize this equipment and resume those services. So every service that we are supposed to have here at the Wilmington HCC is back up and functioning. And we did install a filtration system that allows us to sterilize the equipment, but unfortunately we still do have a water issue within the facility because the water's not potable.
And where is that going now? Where are we with the water issue? Is there a theory as to what the problem is?
There's been all kinds of theories right now. It's really an issue between our building owner and the New Hanover County Health Department. They're working on that. I do know that the building owner had contracted with an outside engineering consulting firm to come in, evaluate the facility, look at the schematics, the engineering diagrams and all that, and put together some recommendations for the building owner. So where they're at this process, we're waiting to see when those things are going to be implemented and hopefully have the issue resolved as far as the potable water so it's drinkable for staff and patients. So that's being worked on. We do have water coolers and water available for staff and patients to drink. It's just that right now with the faucet, the water's not potable. But all of our services are back up and where we're supposed to be. So,
and one of the other issues that has come up a lot at these town hall meetings is service members being able to get appointments, being able to get seen by a medical professional. Why has that been so difficult?
Well, again, I'll go back to with the number of veterans that are returning from these various conflicts that we've had in the recent years, the demand for our services are really outstripping our supply.
Do you know how many veterans you need to be able to serve at this point? Do you have a number?
Well, right now, based on the number of primary care teams that we have at the facility, we have 8 primary care teams and a women's health team, depending on whether it's an MD or a mid-level, a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant. An MD can handle 1,200 patients on their panel. The mid-level, the nurse practitioner or physician assistant can handle 900.
And what you're saying is that it's still not enough in terms of the veterans flowing into this area that need care.
Right. So getting providers and additional teams. That's why we're looking at, for example, out in Jacksonville, they just moved, relocated from an old CBOC that was roughly 8,000 square feet to a new 15,000 square foot facility. It's going to allow us to expand the number of primary care teams that they have there. We're going to go to 8 teams there. So previously they had 6. We're also working with DOD and Camp Lejeune for space there and Hadnot Clinic. We're looking at eventually being able to put 2 primary care teams there. And then also in Brunswick County with the Brunswick Community-Based Outpatient Clinic, we're working on getting additional space there to make that facility a little bit larger and add a 3rd team out there. Currently there are 2 teams. So we are addressing the issues of access by trying to bring on additional teams and meet the needs of our veterans in this community.
Could private practice ever help in that regard?
Well, there are some programs. Part of it is with the choice programs. There are some issues with that. We've been trying to get some of our veterans through that. The program, as you mentioned earlier, with some of the stuff that happened back in 2014, the choice program is one of those attempts to get our veterans taken care of out in the community.
That hasn't been the smoothest transition.
No, that has not been the smoothest transition. So, but we are working on making that a better process as well. So we're really trying to meet the demands or the needs of our veterans by making additional ways for them to receive care.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Wilmington VA Healthcare Center Administrator Fred Roche, thank you so much for joining us today. Coming up right after the break, we'll talk with a former VA primary care physician and we'll meet a local military veteran. If you have a question or a comment or would just like to tell us about your own experience with the VA, give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can reach us by email at coastline@whqr.org. You're listening to Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. We're talking today about healthcare access for military service members in southeastern North Carolina. Joining us now is Dr. Kyle Horton. She's a former primary care physician at a VA health center in Virginia. She also served as an assistant professor of internal medicine with Virginia Commonwealth University, the institution that ran the post-deployment clinic for Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom veterans. And she is currently a board-certified internal medicine doctor and a veterans policy advocate. Dr. Kyle Horton, welcome to Coastline.
It's a pleasure to be here.
We also have with us today a man who served in the United States Navy for nearly 10 years, including a tour of duty in Iraq, and he now lives in the Cape Fear region. Michael Ramos, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment for either of our guests or you're a veteran who's used the local VA facilities, give us a call at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Michael Ramos, since we only have you for this segment, could you just tell us briefly about your tour of duty in Iraq and what led to your current disability?
Well, I went to Iraq. I did what we did. I was in the initial invasion, so we just pushed, and then we came home. And there's not a whole lot to talk about it. I mean, you know.
And you actually have a diagnosis.
Yeah, I do. There's a couple of different ones. I was diagnosed with moderate PTSD, and I've got some hip and some knee issues and some other things going on.
So there are physical issues and psychological issues that you require ongoing care for.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't really like the term psychological issues. It makes me sound like I'm broken.
Sorry about that. That wasn't the intention.
No, I'm just
trying to describe it.
Yeah, I get it. But yeah, I do seek VA care.
Yes. So how would you describe it? Because there's a technical way. You mentioned PTSD, and for people who aren't familiar with that term, post-traumatic stress disorder. Dr. Kyle Horton, when you diagnose someone with PTSD, how do you do that? What's the process?
So there are defined criteria that we use as physicians and symptoms that we look for that are laid out in a diagnostic manual that psychiatrists use. And so it's really a matter of sitting down for a prolonged interview, going through what kind of symptoms people have in terms of avoiding triggers, in terms of, you know, sleep disruption, and looking at how it impairs their ability to function in daily life. So that's how we make the diagnosis.
And I'm going to ask you also about your work on the Clay Hunt legislation. This was a veteran who ultimately committed suicide and was one of the triggers, I guess, for waking up the country in terms of the issue that wasn't really being fully addressed. But there, I noticed in reading about him, there was an actual number associated with his disability, 30% disabled, and he was trying to get that number. What does that mean? How do you establish whether someone is 20% or 60%, or what does that mean?
So it's a really difficult and in many cases a very prolonged and troubled process that does impair veterans' ability to get access and coverage for the services that they need. And what happens is when they apply, they will indicate exposures, things like Agent Orange that they might have been exposed to for the Vietnam veterans, or now there's newer exposures like burn pits that they use to dispose of waste close to bases in many cases. And so they log exposures, or then orthopedic issues, sleep disruption that may have begun while they were in service, and then things like PTSD. And then there's a process called compensation pension, where they go through a prolonged interview, physical exam, some lab testing, and then they assign, you know, how likely it is to be related to their service in regards to any certain medical condition. And then over time, that can be reevaluated as things come up affecting the veteran. And then over time, the tendency is for the percentage to increase as well.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking about healthcare access for military veterans in the Cape Fear region, the challenges, the growth here, the needs. With us today is Michael Ramos, a military veteran living in the Cape Fear region, and Dr. Kyle Horton, a former VA primary care physician and current veterans policy advocate. And James tweets, 8 months after getting out, in June 2014, the VA lost my medical and dental records, still waiting on claims. Is this something that we hear frequently in this region? Both of you are nodding your heads, Michael Ramos.
Yeah, it happens very frequently. When I initially, I moved down here from Annapolis, which was my last duty station, and I initially filed my claim at Camp Lejeune, and I filled in the initial paperwork. Nothing happened. Turned out they'd lost my package and claim, so I had to go back and restart it. And so that took some time. And I started, there's a program, the name of it escapes me. I forget a lot of things these days. But where you're on active duty, you're pretty close to getting off of active duty, and it kind of gives you a little bit of an edge. They kind of fast track you. My wife did the same program, and it worked actually pretty well for her.
Your wife is also a military veteran.
Yeah, she is. So they lose paperwork a lot. When I got, to update my page to, or, my marital records and things, they lost the package that I sent in. I had to send it 3 times. And every time they lost it, the clock would start over. It's like, okay, well, now you're back in the queue from the day you submitted. At least that's what was told to me. That could be accurate. That could be inaccurate. But I know that that's what, in my conversations with the VA representatives, that would.
Do you know how much time that included over the whole course of, you know, from the time you filed the first claim until you actually were able to get seen?
It was about a year, I think, from the time I filed my first claim and I got a decision back. I think it was about a year, give or take. It's about what it was, I think.
You're listening to Coastline talking about veterans' access to healthcare in the Cape Fear region. And Veronica from Leland, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Hello, Veronica. Or do we have Kim from Wilmington? Here we go. Kim,
hi.
Are you there? Hi.
Yes, I'm here. Yes, I'm from Wilmington, and I'm a veteran. And I've had nothing but great experiences at the VA clinic here. So I go to the women's clinic, mm-hmm. but I've also been to other areas of the clinic, and it's been great.
So you haven't had any issues in terms of getting seen or delays or calls back? Nope. That's great.
I don't mind waiting. That doesn't bother me. Waiting is standard. So that's never bothered me. So, no, I've had great experiences here. But like I said, I go to the women's clinic because, of course, I'm a female, and it's been really wonderful. And the pharmacy's been really good, too, the pharmacy that's opened here now.
That's good to hear. Good feedback for the folks at the local VA. Kim, thank you so much for your call. You're listening to Coastline talking about military veterans' access to health care here in the Cape Fear region. And this should be Veronica from Leland. Welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. Good afternoon to everyone there.
Good afternoon.
I also use the Wilmington CBOC, as it's called. I'm a bit unique in veterans because I'm also retired military. So I do have alternate sources to go to when things back up. So let me just say, first of all, that while I agree with the last caller that I've had very good, concerned, caring people in the Wilmington clinic, they are hampered by the bureaucracy, and I'm sure that Dr. Horton is shaking her head up and down.
Everyone
right now
in the room is right now.
A good example is just to go for my routine checkup with my primary care VA physician, which was due in November. I called in early October to schedule that that appointment, and the earliest appointment they had was the end of January of this year. Okay, so when Kim says she's used to waiting, we're not talking like if you call your normal primary care physician and they tell you to come back next week. We're talking months.
And
so that's just to throw that out. That wasn't actually the reason I called, but when I listened to the last caller, again, the people there care, but they are so hamstrung by the bureaucracy themselves that they have to go through to try to get the veteran the help and what they need, that it's sometimes the two of you sitting in a room trying to plot your next action to work around the system, which should not be. The reason I called was I am right now in the process of trying to use the CHOICE program, which your earlier guest talked about, the administrator.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And to show you how bad CHOICE is, I have had several. I've had a total of 9 knee surgeries, 2 shoulder surgeries, 2 abdominal procedures, and a heel surgery, and I have other ailments to go along with that. And so, as you can imagine, I'm in a lot of pain most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, what the VA has as part of their tools is opiates, various forms of opiates. Once you get past all of the non-opiate-type drugs, pain-killing drugs, and trust me, if you've been in the military for 20 years, all of us have had our supply of Mobic and all the other things that are out there.
Sure.
Those don't work anymore. And so you're looking for alternatives, and if you spent any time in the military and don't do drugs, because we get your analysis, we don't do drugs, the last thing you want to do is be told that you get this industrial-sized bottle of opiates here, this is your cure. That's not the cure, especially when you know there are alternate medicines out there. So I, on my own, out of my own pocket, have tried to use things like acupuncture and Tai Chi and yoga, which are both hard for me because I can't keep up with, you know, this is a 20-year veteran, so this pains me to say, I can't keep up with the old ladies in the classes because they're just things my body won't do right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to the CHOICE, said to my primary care physician, can we try acupuncture? Because that has worked in the past, but it gets expensive when it's out of pocket.
Sure.
And no insurance company covers acupuncture for the most part. She said, sure, let's put this in. And that was back about this time last year that she originally put it in paperwork for that. Well, because I didn't make my November appointment, I didn't find out that CHOICE had actually approved her request from several months ago for me to have acupuncture. No one called me. No one sent me a letter. Nobody notified me. It wasn't until I went to my appointment the end of January that she looked in a computer and said, oh, it was approved. Okay, so what do we do now? So I called the CHOICE program and said, okay, I understand there's a referral in the system for me to go to acupuncture. What do I need to do? I gave them the information they needed from me. They told me to call back in 5 business days. It happened to be a Monday that I was speaking to them. I said, okay, I'll give you till Friday. They said Friday. I gave them till Wednesday. When I called back the following Wednesday, they said, oh, did they tell you 5 business days? They really should have told you 10 business days.
So, Veronica, what you're describing is just a complete breakdown in follow-up and communication and any kind of consistency. Dr. Kyle Horton, is this something that you have seen on a regular basis? When you were working in Virginia, were the issues similar?
The issues were very similar, that it would be probably 6 to 8 months minimum from when a veteran initially tried to get into the VA system at that time when I was working in Richmond doing the post-deployment clinic, as you said, for the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans. And then from then, a few weeks after I started, I was booked out for 4 months almost immediately. And when you look globally with the size of my patient panel, which was much larger than what I had anticipated, given that I had teaching responsibilities and was also supposed to be doing some inpatient work, I was allotted essentially 2.4 visits per patient per year. And by and large, veterans care is complicated. We have a lot of really sick patients. The exposures put them at risk for a lot of chronic medical conditions that are exacerbated by many cases, PTSD, patients with traumatic brain injury. Oftentimes, it's difficult to interview them, and it's difficult to figure out exactly how best to help some of these veterans that have so many overlapping issues and concerns. So Veronica's experience, I think, is very par for the course, that as we were winding down the two wars, that the VA really wasn't proactive in making sure that we had the number of providers and the staffing levels that we would need. And when you combine that as well, that with the recession, and the other way that a lot of people qualify is by means testing, by being indigent and having no other source of health care, that sort of double whammy just created so much demand within the system, and there just were not enough providers to take care of that.
And when Veronica was describing the use of opioids to cope with the pain over what sounded like, I'm not a doctor, I don't know, but is that common to use opioids for such a long time?
It's really been a problem. It's something I'm working on some policy advocacy right now. Actually, a piece of legislation came through the Senate Veterans Committee and passed unanimously in December to address VA opiate safety. Because when there are delays, a lot of time what happens is initially it's appropriate. Someone has, you know, an acute injury on top of chronic back pain. You go ahead and give them some opiates. That's a perfectly fine usage of it. But then what happens is they get delayed getting to pain management, or they get delayed getting to ortho. So then what happens is other people are filling in. They keep refilling the medication and go ahead and send it. And then they end up being on a very long course of opioids that was of questionable efficacy or clinical indication. So the piece of legislation is really aiming to improve the VA's adherence to clinical practice guidelines that we would usually use for opiates.
And does that create more of an addictive issue? I mean, are there more people who fall into abusing opioids because they're used for longer term than they might be in civilian life?
It does. And we know younger patients are more vulnerable globally because of your psychological development and how you develop emotional maturity through lifetime. And that also people with PTSD and some other conditions are more likely to use opiates to self-medicate for things like inability to sleep or, you know, interrelated with worsening pain from their PTSD. So then there have been significant issues with opiate addiction, and there have also been issues with patient deaths, unfortunately, where we've had suicides interrelated, that opiates were the means for suicide. And then, you know, the medications that we use to replace opiates when we're trying to get them off, like Suboxone, they're very high risk medications. So then there have been deaths related to, you know, using Suboxone in conjunction with other medications that were prescribed by psychiatrists. And so it's really something that's been a tremendous problem.
And when Veronica first brought this up, both of you were nodding your heads about the free availability of opiates. Michael Ramos, is this something that you've encountered in your own experiences?
Yes and no. I actually have a similar story about the choice program, just for my eyeglasses, but similar breakdowns in communication. For me, it was looking at the file. You do suffer from PTSD. You are having some sleep loss. Let's start prescribing medications. I was like, no, absolutely not. And then the VA providers were like, just stymied for a minute. And they're like, well, we can offer you prescriptions. I was like, well, I don't want prescriptions. I want coping mechanisms. I want to learn to get better, to take care of myself. I don't want to be addicted to, oh, I need my pills to make me feel better today. I need these drugs to make me feel better today. And in some cases, I realize it, especially on our caller, when there's a pain management issue, fine. But mm-hmm. It just seems like that's the go-to. Let's throw some medicine at people that, you know, maybe they just need somebody to talk to. They just need care. I mean, it's really easy for me to sit here in the safety of this room and say, this is what's broken, without having the time to say, these are the solutions. But at the same time, we need a better solution than just opioids. I mean, there's a lot of contraindications. If you have TBI or PTSD that's contraindicated for opioids, that's a huge problem. Well, mm-hmm. for years they've been doing that, and now they just found out maybe it was a mistake. Oops, sorry, guys.
And there's so much around healthcare for military veterans that we're just learning. It's such an evolving process. Dr. Kyle Horton, you've dealt with veterans from so many different combat theaters. Can you talk about how some of those injuries vary?
Yeah, so, I mean, as you said, in the 70s and ongoing after the Vietnam Wars, when we really started to identify that veterans have unique issues in healthcare. And so really we're in, you know, a newer spectrum of knowledge, and the evidence is not as robust as many other fields. And without a VA system that had a unified data collection and electronic medical record, it becomes even harder to do research on populations like veterans. But if you look at Vietnam veterans, certainly there are unique exposures to each combat theater. So Vietnam veterans' exposure to Agent Orange is linked to blood cancer. So there's lymphomas, multiple myeloma, even type 2 diabetes has been linked to Agent Orange exposure. For younger veterans, And of course, type 2 diabetes as well, it has been part and parcel linked with patients having a much higher incidence of ischemic cardiomyopathy, where their heart doesn't function as well, and that's something that we see quite commonly. For younger veterans, traumatic brain injuries, shrapnel, and multiple limb injuries, and then, of course, PTSD is prevalent in both Vietnam veterans and in our Iraq and Afghanistan veterans.
But PTSD isn't something we even diagnosed in Vietnam veterans until recently, is that right?
Yeah, isn't that amazing that, you know, the concept of post-traumatic stress, and it's really almost a normal physiologic response to stress, but it's not been recognized.
You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 FM. Thanks so much to military veteran Michael Ramos for joining us today. We're talking about military veterans' access to health care. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and we're talking today about the challenges military veterans face when they return from service, what's available to them in southeastern North Carolina, and how we might bridge some of those service gaps that exist. With us right now is veterans policy advocate and former VA primary care physician, Dr. Kyle Horton. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, you have one segment left. Give us a call at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. And we have Steve. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Hi. So I'd like to start this off with, I'm not trying to, and I'd sort of attack the VA. I just wanted to discuss, if we could, back to the rating process.
Talking about the disability rating process.
Certainly. So I'm a first Gulf War veteran, and my experience was, I went to the first Gulf War. I was with a unit from Germany. We were close to where they were blowing up large numbers of chemical munitions. You know, we actually quit and turned off our chemical alarms because they kept going off. Shortly after that, I started developing, you know, joint pains and muscle pains that didn't really fit arthritis or fibromyalgia. Around 96, I left the military, left the Army under a medical discharge, and then I went to the VA system and got my initial rating. And that process seemed to be designed, not the people that were administering it, but the process itself seemed to be designed to basically deny any services. So they gave me the lowest possible rating, was at a 10%, and sent me on out the door. Since then the reason I'm calling is, you know, they were saying that the tendency is that this rating goes up. Well, since then, in my condition, I go and I've gone, and I have no experience with a VA clinic here. But the last time I went was Winston-Salem, and I went for a review of this. So I left the military. There is no treatment. There's nothing you can do. I certainly never went to the VA because I've got to eat, and the time limit to go to the doctor, and especially for a treatment that doesn't exist, for a thing that you don't say exists. So then I go in, and I'm like, well, hey, you know, this pain is worse. And they're like, well, you've never come in for treatment. There's no proof. No. And the guy actually was like, well, it doesn't fit fibromyalgia. And it's like, yeah, no kid. And that was the thing they gave me. So
That was the diagnosis then? Or
yeah, well, essentially they shoehorned me into a diagnosis and said, oh, okay, well, we'll call it fibromyalgia, and here's your 10%, and go on about your business. But, you know, do my symptoms fit fibromyalgia? No, I've got, like, joint and muscle pains, but, you know, if I'm honest about it when I'm talking to the doctor, I, they're not going to be exactly fibromyalgia, and I don't know what it is. I mean...
So are they treating you with medication for fibromyalgia? Is that...
No, there's no treatment at all. I mean, it's just, I just gave up, and I just am in pain and have been since I was 22, and now I'm in my late 40s, you know?
Steve, let's get Dr. Kyle Horton to respond to this. Is this a kind of circumstance that you've seen before? What kind of pain might Steve be referring to? And I realize you can't make medical diagnoses here on the air, but what do you think about that, Mike, about Steve's story?
So we have seen very similar stories, particularly in patients, and this is where the label of Gulf War Syndrome has come in with a lot of veterans, that there's a chronic multi-system illness. And there's been a lot of debate and a lot of research ongoing about trying to figure out how to treat Steve's kind of pain that is overlapping with joint-related pain like an arthritis, and that does have usually elements of fibromyalgia. And a lot of times fibromyalgia is considered a service-connected diagnosis, which is what they gave him. But in terms of treatment, we've had really limited options. We know that people utilize care more frequently, that they have more issues with managing their pain and not responding to opiates, because that would not normally be an opiate-responsive pain.
So is Gulf War Syndrome then something sort of like a catch-all? Like, we know he has pain and it doesn't fit into one of the known categories, so this is our... We're calling it Gulf War Syndrome?
It's almost becoming a catch-all, yes, for something that we can't truly pinpoint as a single diagnosis. And it's something where there's an evolving base of literature, and it's something where I'm passionate about trying to study and get more funding to the VA to go towards things like acupuncture, to go towards more, you know, yoga, meditation, and other means to address chronic pain that's related to situations like Steve.
Steve, thank you so much for your call. We have an email. He says, I'm also Steve, an older military veteran, have volunteered at the Wilmington CBOC in years past. I am friends with Dr. Horton and networking in southeastern North Carolina with others interested in horticulture therapy and or farming, own a farm in Willard. I've networked with former Marine veteran Robert Elliott of Cypress Hall Farms in Lewisburg, also in North Carolina. Our goal is to help veterans who have been suffering from post-traumatic stress by introducing them to farming and working alongside them, tutoring, training, and guiding them. This is being put together under the leadership and direction of the Farmer Veteran Coalition. As part of the larger picture, these veterans replace retiring farmers. What is the Farmer Veteran Coalition, Dr. Horton?
So it's an amazing group, and there have been different foundations established and coalitions to support this. So really, it's an initiative to provide veterans with an occupation, a sense of purpose, and, you know, really a therapeutic outlet, because that's something that we all see, is that the transition to civilian life is very difficult, and it's only compounded by post-traumatic stress and other problems. But when veterans go from, you know, the battlefields to having a purpose at home, something where they can work with their hands, they're able to, you know, stay active, that they transition much better into civilian life. So this is really where this initiative comes about. And we have both farmer veterans who have never farmed before, and we have people that grew up farming that never thought they would go back to farming that have found purpose in it again. So it's really been a privilege. In the same way, we worked on a project recently to provide writing and photography, you know, giving veterans alternative outlets to express, you know, their emotions and to deal with their combat experiences is often proving very successful and more successful than medications or conventional treatments that we might think of.
As we've alluded to before, the suicide rate among veterans is very high. Do you know what the number is now, what the most recent research shows? Is it 22 suicides a day?
There are conflicting numbers right now. The initial number of 22 came about because of extrapolated data from death certificates. So the range was 18 to 22 estimated veterans committing suicide per day. And
Per day
in this country, which is staggering. It is staggering. And when you look at female veterans, they complete suicide at about six times the rate of non-veteran women in this country, which is equally as staggering. And there's a new piece of legislation that's kind of a partner to the Clay Hunt Save Act, which was the Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act passed the House.
That's good news. Why is the rate higher with female veterans?
So we're looking into that. It's likely people surmise that it's interrelated with military sexual trauma in many cases. The use of firearms is much more prevalent in women in terms of what their means are to complete suicide. And when you look at the women in general, a lot of times with the use of pills, you have time to intervene and that, you know, that you can actually try and save someone and bring them back. But the use of firearms is one of the predictors that is likely related to the higher rate among women veterans.
When you were practicing as a primary care physician at a VA health facility, Dr. Kyle Horton, what did you see in terms of just your patients and women and sexual trauma in the military? How did that come about and how widespread was that?
It was very widespread, and especially in seeing the younger veterans and doing the post-deployment clinic for the Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, it was a very prevalent problem. And it was very difficult in the way that the clinics were set up, and it's something where the VA has been evolving, because even being in the clinics is a trigger for a lot of women who were sexually assaulted. That you can imagine if you've been through that and then you're walking into the VA and a lot of people will wear camouflage or they have a veteran hat on, that is really disruptive and emotionally difficult.
So why do you think it's so widespread in the military? Why are women at such risk in the armed forces?
You know, I don't know. I think it's something where there's something in the culture that over time, I started undergraduate at Annapolis and didn't stick with the service. But I came in at the wake of Tailhook actually happening, if you remember that scandal. And they were coaching us about ways to ensure that you were safe, that you wouldn't go to the restrooms alone and put yourself in situations at risk. That's sort of victim blaming. And it's something where I feel like the culture has been such that when it was reported, it wasn't dealt with and people were not appropriately reprimanded and disciplined. So then it becomes a culture that perpetuates itself. And I feel like it's something where societally we need to look at, you know, how we are raising our boys and our women as well, because men are victims of military sexual assault as well, and in staggering numbers too.
When you are working as a primary care physician, this is something that you screen for routinely? How do you do that? Because normally, if a civilian walks into a checkup with a primary care physician, I'm not sure that that's a routine part of the screening, but you have a whole different process that you have to undertake when you're dealing with military veterans.
That's exactly right. So, and this is part of the concern as there is discussion of privatizing more of veterans' healthcare, is that there are a lot of routine screenings that we don't do. So normally in, you know, your private practice, you may have 15 minutes for a patient visit, 30 minutes for a new patient. We allot more time within the VA system, and usually these screenings would be done before the patient ever comes back to see me in primary care. And that would include screenings for military sexual assault, screenings for post-traumatic stress disorder, screenings for traumatic brain injury, screenings for those kind of exposures that we talked about, Agent Orange exposure, exposure to burn pit probably is coming. So there is a series of questionnaires that the patients do before they ever come back to assess whether or not that's something that we need to address. And that would not be something that's normally going to be done in private practice.
And so there would need to be some kind of education of primary care physicians who are starting to deal with military veterans then, if...
Absolutely. And right now, there are no directed board questions or anything like that that we get in directed training about exposures or particular veteran-specific risks to suicide and conditions like that. So a lot of the training that we get is really through the VA system that doctors and nurses learn by rotating through VA hospitals and VA medical centers.
You've mentioned now Clay Hunt. There was some federal legislation that passed that was based on this man's story. Can you tell us who he was and what that legislation was about?
So Clay Hunt was a Marine sniper, and he was a member of the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans for America and worked with them. And it was my privilege to work with them in concert on this piece of legislation. And for all intents and purposes, Clay was really, you know, someone who adjusted well. He had done multiple deployments and went back to serve. He had got involved in mission work and really was seemingly coping well with
when he was out of the military. He started doing this humanitarian work.
He was doing tremendous humanitarian work and really was an active person coaching others through the process and how to, you know, transition effectively to civilian life. But that said, you alluded to the problems that he had. He had problems with delays in care. He moved. A lot of veterans move when they're first home and they're transitioning. So then each time he would get fragmented a little bit, a longer delay, and then he had difficulties dealing with the medications. There were a lot of medications that he had tried, and I know bits and pieces of his story from working with his stepfather, who came to Greensboro, and actually we did a behavioral health phase summit to try and dissect some of the issues that went on with Clay and how faith intersects with post-traumatic stress and how, you know, that complicated relationship between spirituality, morality, and PTSD in Clay's case may have, you know, contributed to his suicide.
And he ultimately, it was a surprise to people, he ultimately killed himself at age 28. And then you worked on this legislation that now does what?
So the legislation had several key components. One passion of mine and the part that I felt would be the most effective was enhancing peer support within the VA system. And this is really something where they hire a lot of veterans into the VA, in many cases who have been through the system and seen some of the problems. And they're able to serve as sort of case managers and coach through because they have that sort of trust and the knowing of another veteran who shared their experiences. Other components were pilot programs to hire more mental health providers and actually provide greater loan forgiveness. And then there was also measures to put together annual health summits where they would pull together veteran service organizations in much the way that we do these town halls, but actually try and get providers together in the community so that there's less fragmentation in care and we can actually figure out what are the best practices to address suicide and figure out where the problems are and gaps in care.
And that's this edition of Coastline. I'd like to thank our guests, Wilmington VA Healthcare Administrator Fred Roche, military veteran Michael Ramos, and Veterans Policy Advocate Dr. Kyle Horton. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Join us next Wednesday for Coastline. That's Wednesday, February 17th at 12:06 here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Coastline's executive producer is Cleve Callison. Our producer is Isabel Shepherd. Our technical director is Ken Campbell. And if you missed part of today's show, look for it on our website at whqr.org or subscribe to the podcast from the iTunes Store.
I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.